The greatest trick the devil ever pulled was convincing the world he didn't exist.
I saw a pale horse,
a beast.
We're told in the Book of Revelation,
this is not a human child.
Isn't an angel?
Satan! Armageddon is almost upon us.
Order the use of nuclear weapons.
The world is a fine place and worth fighting for.
From one end of the world to the other, I will oppose you.
They're here.
Welcome to the end of the world.
Wrestling not against flesh and blood, but against powers and principalities. This is PID Radio.
One of the biggest questions of prophecy scholars, perhaps the biggest question, is exactly who will be the Antichrist? Welcome to the Prophecy Summit at Branson 2012. I'm Derek Gilbert, co-host of PID Radio, on the web at PIDradio.com, VFTB.net, or a view from the bunker. Our guest, founder, editor, and publisher, or CEO of WorldNet Daily, WND.com, writes a daily column for WND and a weekly syndicated column. He's founded WND Books, has written and collaborated on 14 books that have sold more than 10 million copies, written for such publications as the Wall Street Journal, Jerusalem Post, National Review, TV Guide, Reason, Los Angeles Times, many others. He's been sought after by media giants such as NBC Television, New World Entertainment, and others as a consultant, and speaks frequently on issues ranging from domestic policy to the situation in the Middle East. It is our honor and pleasure to welcome Joseph Farah to the Prophecy
Summit. Nice to be with you, Derek.
Your presentation yesterday caused some discussion over the dinner table last night.
I bet it did.
Bill Salas joined us for dinner last night. And, of course, you're familiar with Bill. He's written the book,
sure.
Israelistine, and a number of others. Your theory that you've come up with about the identity, or at least the origins, of the Antichrist.
Well, first of all, it's not my theory.
Okay, all right.
I was here, actually, to promote a book that we've published called Mideast Beast by Joel Richardson. And it's not his theory either. It is a theory that goes back many hundreds of years. You can look back at some of the early church fathers from the very time of Islam's birth. There were many who suspected that Islam and the Islamic Empire in particular would be the final empire that Jesus would come back to destroy. So is that a new theory? But what we've seen over the last 100 years, 50 years in particular, in evangelical America, is an adaptation of another theory, which is that there's going to be a Roman Antichrist.
Right.
And this has, of course, been popularized by books like Late Great Planet Earth and many others. And what Joel Richardson, which is a pseudonym, by the way, because he spends a lot of time in the Middle East just talking to Muslims, evangelizing Muslims, and for his own protection, he uses the name Joel Richardson. Waleed Shubat, a very prominent former terrorist, has also helped to repopularize this theory about the Islamic Antichrist. And essentially it comes down to this, and this is what I talked about in my presentation at some length. If you look at the return of Yeshua and who he is doing battle with, the specific nations named, every single one of them is today an Islamic nation. They're all neighbors of Israel. They're all Middle Eastern countries. We have sort of, I think, looked perhaps, I don't want to say too deeply into some obscure Bible verses, because you can never look into the Bible, you know, with too much attention. But at the same time, we've come to the conclusion, many evangelicals have come to the conclusion, through man's teaching, I believe, that there's going to be an invasion by Russia of Israel.
The Gog-Magog war.
There's going to be an invasion by China of Israel. There's going to be a worldwide government, and there's going to be no, at some point, there's going to be no opposition to this Antichrist figure. None of those things, I believe, are supported by the Bible whatsoever.
Hmm.
When you look at the actual, there is opposition to the Antichrist in the Bible. There is a judgment of the nations when Jesus returns, and some nations are judged as goats and others as sheep. If they were all unified behind an Antichrist, there would be no need for sorting out sheep and goat nations. On and on. I think when you take this fresh look at what the Bible says, and you don't get too messed up with, and believe me, I'm not denigrating any of the other teachers. As I pointed out in my presentation also, a lot of those books that I wrote that you mentioned in the introduction, I wrote with prominent evangelical authors who subscribe to this conventional traditional theory, including Hal Lindsey. I wrote 6 books with Hal Lindsey. Mm-hmm. So I believed every single one of these precepts for a long time. And the change came for me really at 2 different times. One, I was in a prophecy conference making a presentation, and one of the other presenters was Waleed Shubat. And he said some things that touched my soul. There were some things that I just always had, even though I wrote them and I talked about them and I sort of believed them, I always had doubts. And I really believe that this whole Gog-Magog situation in Ezekiel 38, for instance, is a relic of the Cold War era, when the Soviet Union was so scary to people in the West that we made the beast something that it was not to be. I don't believe there's any danger of Russia invading Israel anytime in the foreseeable future anymore. And we ought to look at that and say, yeah, could Magog actually be something other than Russia? And in fact, what we began to do, Joel, Waleed, and some of the other folks like me who've been studying this, we went back and we looked at every ancient map we could find, some hundreds of years old, some even older than that. Every single one of those ancient maps places Magog in Turkey.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes sense, because we are headed very rapidly right now toward a caliphate, which is probably going to be headed, as it was during the Ottoman Empire, by Turkey. And so we see a lot of the pieces lining up that suggest to us Islam is the perfect Antichrist religion. You also have this component of their own eschatology, the Islamic eschatology, which is sort of it almost stands biblical eschatology on its head. Isa, who they is their name for Jesus, comes back, and he is the representation of what we would call the false prophet.
Right, because he points to the Mahdi.
That's right. Yeah. He points to the Mahdi, who is more like the anointed Messiah figure in the Bible. And it's a religion that specifically rejects there is a Son of God, which is, you know, one of the, I mean, you'd have to say that's an antichrist religion. That's about as antichrist as you can get when you say that Jesus is not the Son of God. So there's a lot of information there. There's a lot of, and I present this information, I say to people, make up your own mind. This is not a matter of salvation. This is not a, I like the open debate and discussion that we have at these kinds of conferences because it gets people to think. I think people like Bill Salas, who may disagree on some points with me, he's given me material that makes me think. And, you know, he may be right about some of the things he says, and I may be right about some of the things I say. And but ultimately, we ought to judge it all by a thorough Berean-like study of the Bible.
Well, I can't disagree there. I mean, if we're willing to, if we calcify our beliefs around, you know, say a book that we've written or some such, I think we run in danger of holding fast to that instead of Scripture, which is the ultimate guide to truth. But there are some things that I'm curious about. I didn't have the opportunity to hear your presentation, and things that I have learned or picked up over the years, perhaps by osmosis, that that raise some questions. The identification of Turkey as Magog makes sense. The restoration of the caliphate And Bill Salas probably mentioned this to you, because I know he mentioned it at dinner last night. Mm-hmm. The Ezekiel 38, Psalm 83 wars, regardless of which order, in which order they take place, would seem to indicate that the nations surrounding Israel are going to be devastated. How would the caliphate reestablish itself? Would that happen before Psalm 83?
I'm not at all convinced that happens. See, Bill is convinced that happens.
Right.
I believe that Ezekiel 38-39 war, the war of Gog, is the Antichrist.
Gog is a person. Yeah,
mentioned
the title
in Revelation by John as certainly sounding like the Antichrist figure himself. We believe that that is the final judgment. In fact, if you read a little bit further in Ezekiel, what does it say? It says that after this war, God's name will no longer be profaned. And so therefore, if his name is no longer profaned by any nations, how could there be an Antichrist that emerges afterwards? Because the Antichrist is going to profane God's name worse than anybody ever did in history. Mm-hmm. So therefore, I believe that Ezekiel 38 is related to every single one of these other prophecies that I enumerated at probably too great length during my presentation. I went through scripture after scripture after scripture, and I said, look, show me where any other nations besides these Middle Eastern, now Islamic nations, are judged by Jesus when he comes, or judged or destroyed by Yeshua when he returns. And there just simply aren't any. We've alluded to, you know, a lot of people just take it by faith that somehow China is going to put together a 200-million-man army and invade the Middle East. But the kings of the East has never met China when they're referred to in the Bible. The kings of the East are, you know, Assyria, Iran, and so forth. And China is not building a 200-million-man army, even though they might have the population to do it. But there is a population that is building specifically a 200-million-man army to invade Israel, and that is the Islamic Empire that's being put together right now. So, I believe everything that happens in the Bible is going to happen, but we just are not interpreting it exactly correctly.
Okay. The other question that comes to mind then is the city of Seven Hills, which is referenced, the Seven Hills on which Mystery Babylon sits, which most take as a reference to the Roman Catholic Church, the city of Rome, mm-hmm. The seat of this new one-world religion. How does that factor into your analysis?
I don't believe that's Rome at all. I don't believe Rome. Rome is not mentioned in judgment in the Bible at all. I don't see Rome getting destroyed. I believe Mystery Babylon is Saudi Arabia. Hills and mountains. I believe the term is mountains in the Bible, not hills.
Right.
There are no mountains in Rome. They are hills.
Right. Right.
Okay, so if we're talking about a nation of seven hills, we might be talking about Rome, city of seven hills. We're talking about Rome. But if you're talking about a nation that sits on seven mountains, you're not talking about Rome at all. Mountains are usually representative of nations or people in the Bible. And so Joel makes, I think, a very persuasive case in his book, both the Islamic Antichrist, his first book, and Mideast Beast, that Saudi Arabia is Mystery Babylon.
So then the Wahhabist sect somehow factors into this? Or let me start again, rephrasing the question. How then would this particular brand of religion practiced in Saudi Arabia, which is a particular interpretation of the Quran and, mm-hmm. and the Hadith, transform into a one-world religion that draws all nations in?
There really isn't a one-world religion, also as we think of it, because it has immense power, this caliphate. In the Bible, it talks about all the world having drunk the wine of this Mystery Babylon.
Right.
The wine is oil. Saudi Arabia has immense power throughout the world. It has influence beyond our imaginations in the United States. I could talk about that from a strictly secular point of view for hours, in mm-hmm. fact, throughout the West, Europe, and so forth. I believe that's what we're talking about. We've been corrupted And, of course, they also are the nation that is responsible for spreading Islam throughout the world more than any other, with all the madrasas, millions, hundreds of millions of dollars put into American education and Harvard and other institutions of higher learning. That's Mystery Babylon, and that's how it's corrupting the whole world. But again, you know, sometimes when the Bible says the whole world, it's talking about the whole world from a biblical sense. It's not talking about what's happening in Latin America or in Japan. The Bible never makes references to those countries. The whole world from a biblical point of view is, generally speaking, the whole world that it's been talking about since day one, which is, this is a very Israel-centric document. It's a very Middle Eastern centered document. And the whole world is that whole world we've known throughout all of the empires of the world, the Babylonian, Assyrian, and so forth. It's basically that. That's where the empire is going to be based. Mm-hmm. And there are going to be nations in opposition to that empire that the Antichrist rules over, which I think should be good news to us, you know, whether you believe in a premillennial rapture or not, that there's always going to be opposition to this evil empire that arises.
So this Antichrist, then, we're told, arises, and he confirms a covenant, a peace treaty with mm-hmm. Israel?
Yes.
Okay. Based on your understanding of the politics of the region, how willing would the Israelis be to cut a deal with a presumably charismatic Islamic leader who rises to power?
Unbelievably willing. Willing beyond our imaginations. And I know this is one of the problems that a lot of folks, I remember, like, I sat at Hal Lindsey's, you know, feet for 10 years, and he said, well, you know, the Jews will never allow an Islamic to sit in the temple and so forth. Right now, the plans are being made. We can see it happening. There are meetings taking place between chief rabbis in Israel and Turkish leaders to rebuild the temple as a temple for the whole world. The Jews are ever so willing to accommodate. Haven't we seen this from the Oslo Accords on, that the Jews are willing to do anything to buy peace on man's terms, without considering the fact that God has given them this land. It's His land. It's not their land. It's His land. They're stewards, and they've mishandled it throughout history, and I think they're going to do it again.
Hmm. You mentioned that the world, when looking at the Bible, and the world is referenced, they're talking about essentially the world around Israel, Mediterranean,
mm-hmm,
as far east is about Iran, Persia. One of the big questions,
North Africa,
sure.
You know.
One of the questions that arises every time we start talking about what happens when all of these things come to pass, given our geography, is what happens to the United States? Is the right. United States even mentioned in prophecy? What is your view?
I don't see it specifically mentioned, which, you know, has always led me to believe, you know, one of a couple of things is that America loses a lot of its power and influence, or we're one of those nations that are very kind of mentioned, not in with any detail, who come up and fight against the Antichrist. Now, that makes sense to me, because look at our involvement in the Middle East over the last 20 years. We've been in and out of there so many times, and it seems like we might be on the verge once again of getting involved because of Iran's nuclear forces. There is a very strong commitment in America to Israel. It doesn't matter who is in the White House, and it doesn't even matter which party is in control of Congress. Congress has always had a very strong commitment to Israel. Is Congress, are the American people going to watch Israel be attacked and destroyed without acting? Very hard to imagine in the foreseeable future that that's going to happen. So I don't see America becoming part of the beast kingdom. That's one of the other options that has always been out there. I hope that's not the case. I know we see a lot of evidence to suggest that, you know, we're losing our Christian Judeo-Christian moral system, our beliefs, our commitment to God's law, and so forth. But at the same time, there is this, particularly with the large evangelical community, a very strong commitment to Israel. So I would, if I'm going to guess, and that's all it is, would be a guess, I think the U.S. is going to be in opposition to the Antichrist. And I don't believe that America is going to be part of this system where you can't buy and sell without the permission of the Antichrist. I don't believe there are going to be chips and so forth that require us to do so. I think times are going to be very, very difficult in that tribulation for everybody around the whole world. If you can imagine having no oil, we've come close a few times, and that's going to make life very, very difficult.
In recent years, we've heard calls from left and right here in the United States. For example, former Secretary of State and possible vice presidential candidate Condoleezza Rice said back in 2008, the time has come for a two-state solution. Mm-hmm. Certainly, that appears to be the policy of the Obama administration. Secretary of State Clinton has called for U.S. involvement and world involvement in the inner affairs of Syria. We backed what now appears to be a Muslim Brotherhood uprising in Egypt, and perhaps Syria and Libya as well. Mm-hmm. How are our actions now going to lead to what you see as the rising of the Islamic Antichrist?
It seems to me that the judgment of the nations largely comes down to one thing, and that is how those nations treated Israel. And if they were part of dividing the land, there are going to be consequences. Now, there's no denying that the United States has been a part of that international pressure to divide the land. Hasn't been at the forefront of it, but at the same time, I think this is the most important thing for Americans to grasp, especially Christian Americans. We need to understand, hey, you know, we're simply grafted into the promises of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob through our faith in Jesus Christ as our Lord and Savior. And so, you know, we need to look at that, that this modern state of Israel, with all of its flaws, was put there by God on a specific timetable, and it is the most important sign of his imminent return. So therefore, the very worst thing we can do, literally, I mean, there's a lot of horrible things that this country is doing with abortion and same-sex marriage and all of these abominations, but the very worst thing we can do is force Israel to divide the land. Mm-hmm. There will be severe consequences and judgment day for America. It's very important to remember, we're judged as individuals. Nations are also judged as well.
Hmm. I'm going to take that as an opportunity to transition the conversation a little bit into some political discussion. Question arose last night in a roundtable session here. What do we as Christians do coming into the election of 2012 when we look at the big policy questions like that? Mm-hmm. You know, setting aside the hot button social issues like abortion and homosexual marriage, which give the illusion that there's a real difference between the two major political parties. Mm-hmm. What do we as Christians do when we go to the polls in November and look at two major political parties that over the last several administrations have been arguing for a division of Israel?
Yeah, it's a very, very good question. And in 2008, I wrote a book that wasn't very popular, called None of the Above.
I thought it was well needed, much needed, and I was shocked at some of the response to that book from evangelical
Christians. I've never had a more vitriolic condemnation of anything I've ever written besides that book, which I made the case. Basically, the essence of that case was we really shouldn't vote for anyone who is not in true support of the Constitution of the United States. Mm-hmm. And I looked at John McCain's record, and I didn't see that. And half the book is about John McCain, and half of the book was about Barack Obama. I clearly saw that Barack Obama was the worse, and that McCain was the lesser of two evils. Mm-hmm. But I thought that, and I predicted what would happen if Obama won. and I predicted it with great accuracy, that there'd be an uprising that came. We saw that uprising in the form of the Tea Party movement in 2010. Now, where do we go from here? Do we apply the same principles? I think we're in a little bit different situation today. I think we're a little bit closer to imminent disaster for this country. I believe that if Barack Obama is reelected, that the country as we know it will not exist in 2016. It will not, you know, our children will not know an America that we have. The liberty will be gone. I believe that the opposition to Obama will be under attack and persecution like we can't even imagine today. And so therefore, you know, and I haven't written extensively about this yet, but my position is that even though I don't think Mitt Romney has the answers for us, that we need to ensure that Barack Obama is not reelected, for no other reason than to buy ourselves some time. What we really need in this country is we need a revival, a spiritual revival, to get our act together again, mm-hmm. to return to being a nation, one nation under God. And that's going to be, I believe, more difficult with Obama in the White House for four more years. So I may be wrong about this. The principles I set forth in 2008 might be right, but I'm scared. I'll be honest with you. I'm scared of what will happen if Obama's reelected. And so therefore, you know, I have not advocated it at this point yet that people run out to the polls enthusiastically and vote for Mitt Romney. I know I'm not going to do it with any enthusiasm if I do it, but it's a matter of survival for the United States.
Hmm. Yeah, and I'm glad you went in that direction, because I was going to ask you about the column that you wrote last week on this very topic. The direction of the nation over the years that you've been working as a reporter, a columnist, an editor, and so on, what are the most significant and disturbing changes that you've seen?
Well, to me the most shocking thing I can honestly say is that 10 years ago, the very idea that someone would, just anyone would suggest same-sex marriage, it would have been laughed at. And today, through the coercion of courts, despite the will of the people expressed over and over 32 times in 32 states, we're still moving in this direction of illegitimizing marriage as it was defined in the Garden of Eden, mm-hmm. as it was defined, redefined, by the way, by Jesus as that being the only way.
He created a male and female.
And we have still a country that's dominated to a great extent by people who call themselves Christians, and this is happening, and we're moving forward. And you know, if you look at how it's being done, it's being pushed by government, whether it's by the courts, whether it's by the military, whether it's by state legislatures and so forth, over the will of the people. So what we have here is a good, and the culture, of course, but you know, the culture can't actually implement, only government can. And so to me, I would say that this is the most shocking development I've seen, because you can go back only 10 years, see nobody talking about this at all. Then a couple of court cases that seem to be Scalia warning about one, the Lawrence v. Texas case. He said, if we take this action, we can no longer say that marriage is between a man and a woman. Mm-hmm. And everybody said, how ridiculous is Antonin Scalia being, mm-hmm. that if we legitimize sodomy in Texas, that we can no longer, and of course he was absolutely right. Everything he said was right, and you can just see the chain of progression from that decision onward.
And that that case seemed to be a very staged event specifically to bring the issue into the courts.
It was staged indeed.
Yeah.
It wasn't a real – the whole thing was contrived from the incident itself and the invitation of the police into the hotel room and mm-hmm. so forth. It's an amazing story. Yeah.
The last couple of years have brought some things that I never thought I would see. Mm-hmm. We've got a presidential administration now that is openly arguing and defending its right to assassinate American citizens overseas. Yeah. How do we Americans bring our government back to where it is paying attention to the Bill of Rights, which guarantees us a trial by jury of our peers, that we can't be arrested without charge, held indefinitely without charge, writ of habeas corpus,
mm-hmm.
When right now the government admits that there is a secret hit list
of
American citizens overseas, at least for now.
It's going to take some very unusual coalitions to do that. People like us are going to be in strange territory when we're aligned with the American Civil Liberties Union and some unfamiliar company. But on these issues, there's agreement. There's some agreement on the left and some agreement on the right, and we've got to support those test cases in court, even though they might be being brought by people we've seen do terrible, destructive, damage to the United States and other matters. We have to defend the Constitution at all costs. The Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, and the Constitution are our American creed. And so we need to stand behind those two documents like we stand behind the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
Without them, we have no more guardrails, and we become like every other nation in the world. The unique thing that the founders gave us was a break from the old world in a very dramatic way. They weren't perfect. They didn't get everything right. There were terrible institutions like slavery still around. But what they did is beyond compare, because the principle there was removing the shackles from the people and putting the shackles on government. Those shackles on government are breaking up very quickly,
mm-hmm.
and the shackles are going back on the people again, and that's what we've got to watch out for.
Well, how do we convince the people then to stand up and say, you know what, there are some things that you cannot justify in the name of national security. I mm-hmm. would rather assume some risk and take on the personal liberty rather than allow you to view all my email, listen into my cell phone, take pictures of me at the airport to mm-hmm. show you things I only let my wife see.
Right.
How do we get people back to a point where they're saying, life is a dangerous game, and for the price of freedom is sometimes meaning that the government is not looking over my shoulder to keep me safe?
Well, the first thing they got to have is the information. Of course, we all experience things when we go to the airport. We all experience, at the very least, this inconvenience, and I think it's bothering more and more people to be harassed in this way. I think when I talk to people in the airport, they don't believe that this has anything to do with preventing terrorism whatsoever. This is it's setting up control of the American people. If we accept this, we'll accept something worse and something worse. Homeland Security. You've got Homeland Security saying that the real enemies, the real people we got to watch in America are right wing Christians and returning veterans from mm-hmm. wars.
Yeah.
This is who they see are the enemy, not domestic terrorists like Bill Ayers, not foreign terrorists like Al Qaeda, but the salt of the earth people who actually are the spiritual descendants of the people who founded the country,
mm-hmm.
who still believe in the founding principles of this country. So awareness of that is very, very key. And it's one of the things, it's one of the very reasons we started WND.com, is because we bring a different worldview to the mm-hmm. presentation of the news than anybody else. And it's why I started it. It's part of the training that I received in the secular media for 25 years before doing it. I like to shock people by telling them that, you know, I had a very successful career running daily newspapers before the internet. I mean, I had breaks as a young person. When I was 27, I was running the newsroom of a major metropolitan newspaper in Los Angeles. And people say, well, how did you do that? You were a Christian. Wasn't there all kinds of bigotry against you? How could you have risen to that position and positions actually running major metropolitan dailies elsewhere? And I say, well, it's very simple, because the worldview that I brought to the table allowed me to see stories that my colleagues couldn't see. And that was appreciated even by the very secular supervisors and bosses that I reported to. And quite apart from being discriminated against because of my faith, I was actually rewarded, and you know, moved up the ladder at newspaper after newspaper. And it's one of the things that makes WND successful. You can go to WND every single day and find stories that you won't find anywhere else.
Absolutely,
it's not because. It's like we don't even have any competition, because the other news outlets are incapable of seeing those. They're not stories to those people. A story about Christian persecution is not a story to MSNBC.
Mm-hmm.
It simply isn't. They wear different glasses than we do. You know, our glasses are like Jesus glasses, and their glasses are not Jesus glasses. So we're able to see those things and hopefully bring them to the attention of the American people. For 15 years, we've been doing it. The audience is growing all the time. We reach not only Christians but non-Christians as well, even though we have what I think is unmistakably a Christian worldview that defines who we are.
And I'm glad you went that direction, because I wasn't going to let you leave that chair before I asked, you know, how and why WorldNet Daily came to be.
Mm-hmm.
You've taken some flack for your views and for articles that you've published, for columnists that you've chosen to include in your stable there at WND.com. Mm-hmm. Did you anticipate that kind of reaction, that kind of blowback when you launched WorldNet Daily?
When we launched, it was nothing but accolades, because the internet was at a very primitive stage. I mean, the audience in the internet in 1997 was, mm-hmm, probably 1/1,000th of what it is today, maybe less than that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was also dominated by free-spirited people, a lot of libertarians and some Christians and so forth. And here was a news agency which was really defined by its, you know, taking a watchdog role on what government was doing. And I can't tell you that there wasn't any opposition to what we did back then, but it was extremely popular across the board. Even liberals admired what we were doing and have tried to emulate it in their own way with things like the Huffington Post. The opposition, however, in the succeeding years has been immense. And there's been an attempt to demonize everything we do by, mm-hmm, stereotyping and pigeonholing, and these guys are birthers, and they're this and they're that. They shouldn't be allowed to talk on television. And there have been times when those forces have been successful at marginalizing us in such a way that we just don't get the invitations to be on Fox or CNN or what have you. But that hasn't hurt us either. When we've gone through long periods of time without any, attention by the any positive attention by the so-called mainstream media, but we continue to grow and find new audiences all the time.
How difficult has it been to resist the temptation, if there has been any, to take WorldNet Daily in a more mainstream direction in the interest of broadening its appeal?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's funny. We thought we did that, actually. We have for instance, a commentary section,
yeah,
which has the broadest spectrum of political opinion you can find anywhere,
sure,
from extreme left to extreme right, because we love a healthy, vibrant debate and discussion and dialogue. And it's as if no one has really noticed that, other than a lot of diehard WND fans who say, why do you have these crazy people like Bill Press and Ellen Ratner writing for
WND?
Yeah, exactly. And in terms of our news presentation, we apply the highest standards that, you know, I learned. I've been doing this for 35 years. You know, I'm doing the same. I have the same standards and practices today that I did that made me an up-and-coming, young, promising editor who was probably destined to run the New York Times or the Washington Post. Those are the standards we apply today. We haven't changed. It's the so-called mainstream media, which is really a terrible euphemism because they're totally out of the mainstream of American opinion. Those are the folks who have changed. I mean, when you watch MSNBC today, do you really think you're watching the news? You're watching a political agenda being rammed down people's throats almost by force. We don't believe in that. We believe in laying out the facts and letting people make up their own minds about the truth.
The mainstream media, and you mentioned that they've got blinders on. And there's a website that I like to look in on from time to time called Get Religion, which was inspired by somebody who made the comment that the mainstream media doesn't get religion.
Mm-hmm.
Is there an agenda there, or you just see that it's the background of most of the people who are working in positions of influence in the major media who, as you say, just have these blinders on?
Yeah, it's two things at once. The biggest is the fact that, you know, the people who tend to go into journalism, and I can tell you this from firsthand experience, I mean, I was attracted to journalism as a leftist, okay? That's I recently wrote a column, Confessions of a Former Communist, and that was me. Those types of people who want to change the world and move it in the progressive way, those are the people who tend to get involved in journalism. The people who have, views that we would consider more mainstream American tend to get involved in things like engineering and, you know, building things. Mm-hmm. And so you have that working against you. The other thing you have is the ownership problem. The corporate media world is where the corporate titans need to make certain compromises. And we've seen this, for example, at Fox, and I've been very outspoken about it. A lot of people think Fox is a real alternative for the news.
Mm-hmm.
But, we have seen over the years, people probably don't realize the critical role that Saudi Arabia plays in Fox with its important piece of ownership. We've seen Prince Alawid of Saudi Arabia boasts about the fact of how he can pick up the phone, call Rupert Murdoch, and get him to change the content of what he sees on the air when they're talking about, for instance, Islamic riot taking place in France,
right?
Muslim riots. The next thing you know, 30 seconds later, there's no reference to Muslims mm-hmm. rioting. It's just a riot that's taking
teenagers,
place.
Teenagers, yeah.
Yeah. And so there's an insidious force at work. It's both at the top and the bottom, at the people who are on the front lines of reporting and editing, but also at the very top. These are not people with, shall we say, a Christian worldview whose main objective is to pursue truth.
For those of us who are looking for a variety of good news sources that we can use to try to figure out what's really going on in the world,
mm-hmm.
Say other than WorldNet Daily, of course, how would you recommend we go about it? Where do we look for these sources that we can kind of compare one against another and get at some semblance of
it? It's one of the things we do is, you know, besides doing our own reporting and editing, and we've done that from the beginning. We also know that we can't be everywhere at once. I mean, our total editorial full-time editorial force is about 25 to 30 people. So, you know, compare that with some news agencies that have thousands. So what we do is we look at what everybody else is doing, and on any given day we're aggregating the very best of what they're doing. There's good reporting being done occasionally at surprising places. I mean, I've seen some reports recently in the LA Times, used to be my competitor. I used to think no good could come out of the LA Times. But an enterprising reporter at the LA Times who does something good can get it published, and it needs to be, you know, get the attention it deserves. So one of the things we do is we link to it. Just as, you know, this is what has made Drudge so powerful. I think Drudge is a very important player in the new media. It was part of our inspiration. That's all he does is linking to what he sees as the best of what's out there. Now, his interpretation of what is the best is going to be different than yours or mine on any given day. But I think that's the one thing I haven't seen, which is kind of surprising after 15 years, and that is I haven't seen any other overtly Christian news organization built with the internet as its platform.
Yeah.
Not to any, you know, not in any way that is comparable to what we've done with that's attracted a large audience and so forth. I thought we'd see more competition because we're having success. We're having commercial success. We're growing. Now we're not able to go out and get billions of dollars to fund what we do like some other news agencies, like Huffington Post being an example. I think Jesus works with Gideons, and I think that's what we kind of represent in the media world.
Maybe we'll see the next generation spring up here soon. My own observations of the off and on for the better part of 15 years, I was part of the major media. Some of that time working in news, some of it as a talk radio host, and I can tell you that local radio, local media is really struggling. Our main competitor in mid-Missouri, which was the News Talk Leader, a station that dated back to the early, very early days of the medium, I mean the 1920s, was the predominant news talk station in mid-Missouri for generations, has, since I left in 2007, eliminated its news staff. How do you have a news talk station when you've got no news department? What do you see as the future of media when you see old line media, news, print, radio, television, cutting local news coverage, especially to the bone and beyond?
Yeah, radio's in the crisis right now that newspapers were 10, 20 years ago. The newspaper crisis began before the internet, by the way, because I was in it. I knew it was contracting. Before the internet came along, I think there were six cities that had competing newspapers in the entire country. There are fewer today, but and now I think the internet is the internet has allowed people to access information in different ways, a multiplicity of ways. The handheld devices are so critical. And so radio, which has been largely a medium that people depended on in their cars, well, now people are able to bring in, they don't need to listen to AM radio or FM radio. They've got satellite radio. You've got iPods you can plug in. Every kind of device, your phone, you can listen to.
Sure, stream the internet through the phone.
Exactly. Yeah. I actually find myself listening to talk radio more on my iPhone than I do from any radio. Mm-hmm. So the whole industry is in flux. Nobody knows where it's going to go, as you probably have figured out. All of the radio giants are scrambling. A lot of major talk show hosts are thinking about new ways of getting their message out. And so we're going to see some real significant changes. Television is also facing the same thing with the advent of satellite and cable and all the choices. And now Roku and and you know,
yeah, we have three.
All these different kinds of devices where you can make the choices about what you want to see. This is where young people are going. Yeah. I know some of my kids who are, you know, grown up kids. They don't have television in a traditional sense. They don't have cable. They don't have satellite. They have these devices mm-hmm. that yeah. allow them to watch movies when they want to watch them and watch, you know, make their own choices. And so we're a long way from the world that I don't know if you're old enough to remember, but as I was a kid growing up, you know, we had three networks on television. Yeah. We had maybe five or six, seven channels on television that we could watch, and we called it broadcasting. There is no such thing as broadcasting, and none of us are broadcasting. We're all narrowcasting now.
Mm. Yeah, well, thanks to the internet, with a laptop and an internet connection, you can be globally syndicated.
That's right.
Yeah,
it's a good thing.
It's a wonderful time and fascinating when you think about it from a prophetic perspective. We finally live in a day and age where one little internet-enabled device with a camera on it can show the entire world something happening, you know, globally in a matter of moments.
Mm-hmm.
And we see that in prophecy where every nation, every tribe will see him coming back in the clouds.
Exactly.
And now we've got the technology to make it happen.
Mm-hmm.
It's an exciting time to be alive.
It is.
A fascinating conversation. Joseph Farah is the editor and CEO of WorldNet Daily.
Thank you,
Derek. I really enjoyed it. Thank you very much. Hope you enjoyed this as well. Thank you for being here and watching us with us. The Prophecy Summit at Branson 2012 for PID Radio. I'm Derek Gilbert.
Thanks for listening. PID Radio is a production of the PID Radio Network, a division of Gilbert House. Please visit our website at PIDradio.com, where you'll find show notes and links to connect with us on Twitter and Facebook. We wish to thank all those who help undergird and underwrite our ministry through prayers, feedback, and donations. To contact us directly, email us at radio@peeringintodarkness.com. Opening music adapted from The Alchemist's Tower by Kevin MacLeod, www.incompetech.com. Closing music, New Day Coming by Steve Grace, stevegrace.com. Content copyright Gilbert House and is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derives 3.0 Unported License. For more information, see creativecommons.org.
Gonna step up to the microphone, say it loud and clear. A better day is coming soon to get us out of here. A new